Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com.
Hi, Cherian. Hi, Clay. Thank you for being my guest today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I have been eagerly anticipating this conversation because honestly, I have not really, for some reason, I'm sort of embarrassed to admit it, but I have not managed to get the ethics conversation really on the agenda for the podcast. And here we are at like episode 150 or something, and ethics hasn't been discussed in a meaningful way. That's a little confessional on my part. So I rallied you guys together and said, hey, let's have an ethics conversation. And in the middle of this like COVID-19 reality, it seemed like an appropriate time to do that. Before we do that, how about you guys just introduce yourselves to our listeners? Clay, you start.
Sure. Hi, I'm Clay Buck, CFRE. I've realized that 2020 marks my 30th year in fundraising, and it's a little terrifying to me to realize that, but I am the founder and consultant of a firm called Tactical Fundraising Solutions. I'm based out in Las Vegas, Nevada, and probably tweet too much and spend a little too much online, but happy to be here, Jason, and thanks for including me in this conversation.
Yeah, glad, Clay. I'm really glad you're back. You were on the podcast about a year ago, right before the AFPICon, and I don't think we had a very long talk. So I'm glad you come back, and we're going to have a good time. Cherian, you want to introduce yourself as well?
Absolutely. So my name is Cherian Koshy. I am the development director at Des Moines Performing Arts, and met Clay when we worked together with Rogari, the fundraising think tank. Have had an interest in ethics and as it relates to fundraising for a while, but I'm a baby compared to Clay. I believe that this year marks my 22nd year in fundraising. So got some catching up to do to our friend here, but I just want to echo what Clay said and just say thanks for having us on here and for talking about ethics. I think it's an important topic for our sector.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. It is interesting to have the three of us on here. I know we've all been part of discussions on the Rogari website, and I'll admit I can't keep up with you guys who manage to do things on Twitter. I tried it the other day as I was sharing with you, and I tried to do a little bantering, and I couldn't do it really well. I need a little bit more long form formats to have discussions, but what's your thinking? So we'll start with you, Clay. So in the midst of sort of the current reality that we find ourselves in, what is the sort of the ethics of asking? What are the questions we should be asking ourselves? Anybody who's listening to my podcast, I want them thinking critically about the work that we do. So what are the questions you think we need to be asking in terms of asking ourselves? What do you think?
You know, I think any discussion now really has to start with acknowledging and celebrating the difficult time. There's a fair amount of, you know, you should be asking, you should be out there. Yes, true, agreed. But let's really acknowledge and hold up the fundraisers that are really out there in tough situations and scrambling in multiple directions and with boards and leaderships, and nobody knows what's going on. So it's, you know, I really want to acknowledge that this is a tough time and that often our nonprofits and our fundraisers are in tough spots, right? And having that discussion And knowing exactly what to do and the way to approach it is a tough haul, as everybody is right now. If we get into the ethics of it and the responsibility of it, I tend to take the same approach now that I do in a quote unquote normal time. If our relationships with donors are based on exactly that, relationships, and they are transformational relationships rather than transactional money-based situations, then I don't think we should have any problem asking. I don't think there becomes an ethical question of should I or should I not ask because of the ethics involved. It becomes a question of, do I know my donor's values and their beliefs well enough that in times of good or bad, these are the people that believe in this mission, and my job as a fundraiser is to help them realize that through their philanthropy. So I kind of almost feel like it is an ethical discussion, but it's more of a tactical, really looking at what our relationships with donors are right now and what those may look like a month, 6 months, a year from now, and what they were before.
I just, so I'll certainly echo exactly what Clay said and just end up at the same conclusion from a different perspective. And I know your listeners didn't sign on to get a philosophy class, but I'm one to say that there's no view from nowhere. So we always start from the presumption of what is the ethical framework that we live in and work in. And one of the things that I think is dangerous in the sector right now is that we just sort of make it up on the fly when it comes to ethical decision making, or we just say, well, this fits what I feel in my gut, as opposed to saying, what is the, like you said, the critical thinking that goes into what shapes my worldview, and how does this approach some of the decisions that confront me over a long period of time, and am I being consistent with that worldview? So the two dominant paradigms in ethical thinking are deontology and utilitarianism. Deontology focuses on what duties I have, and am I abridging a duty, or am I following a duty when I'm acting? So we have a duty to tell the truth, for example, is the Immanuel Kant example. And then the opposite school of thought is utilitarianism or teleology, which looks at the consequences of an action, the anticipated consequences or the actual consequences of an action, and says, do the consequences justify my action, either avoiding a bad consequence or doing something good? Now, in my personal life, I'm a strict deontologist. I believe in a duty-based theory, but I understand that there are reasons why that doesn't fly sometimes in our professional lives. So I think really in understanding the ethical framework of should I ask, should I not ask, there's certainly an element of reiterating what Clay said in terms of the question really hasn't changed necessarily from BC before Corona to AC after Corona, but rather the how we're doing it, and are we listening to our donors? Or are we approaching it correctly? But there are organizations out there, unfortunately, somehow, that are saying now's not a good time to ask because of all that's happening in the world. And I think the challenge that I have with that thinking is that there are always challenges to asking. So if you're saying contextually, all of your donors are focused on something else, that seems like an odd ethical paradigm to operate within, because there were diseases prior to Corona. And I'm not trying to minimize the impact of Corona. Lots of people are dying and are sick, and that is very important. And the human tragedy is first and foremost. But there are people who are dying of cancer and of heart disease. So if disease is the framework under which you make asks, then there would be no good time for you to ever ask in that situation. Mm-hmm. There are also those who are adversely affected by the socioeconomic stratus that we live in normally, and people who are unemployed and those types of things. Now, again, the human tragedy that we're facing right now with tens of millions of people out of work is quantitatively different, but it doesn't change the qualitative question of economic inequality or those types of things that might impact the ethical nature of the decision. So what I, just to conclude that thought, I would just say, if you believe that it is unethical to ask right now, I would critically investigate and interrogate why you think that's true and walk back into, is it the disease? And then how is this disease different from other diseases? If it's the economy, how is this economic situation markedly different from other economic issues that come into play? And then does that just change the how of the execution of the ask, or does it fully say we don't ask at all? And I think most people would say it, as Clay mentioned, it may change the how. You might say, this person is a restaurateur, we're not going to ask them for a gift right now, or we're just going to talk to them about where they are in their giving cycle or giving priorities and understand them better. But this all goes back to what Clay said of, do we believe in donors as partners in a larger cause that is being resolved, or do we believe in them as transactional ATMs where we as the organization need money and you as the donor need to give us the money?
So, Jason, sorry, we should have forewarned you. Cherian and I have a fair amount of history now of having conversations. So you may not get a word in edgewise for the rest.
I'll get my chance. Let me make something really clear, guys. I'm hosting the party, so I get my chance. And I also get to do the post edits if so necessary.
I appreciate that. That's very good.
Yeah, exactly. But Cherian, I'm going to reply to you, and this is a question that I know has been cycling around, certainly with Rogare and certainly in other circles as well. Right, donor centered fundraising. What is the ethical responsibility to donor centered fundraising, and does that outweigh, if we look at it from a deontological perspective, what is the fundraiser's primary duty? I would argue that if you really look at that from an employment perspective and from an ethical duty perspective, our primary duty as a fundraiser is to ensure the financial health of the organization. That is our employer. That is our job. That is what we are hired to do.
Sure.
It seems to me it's like a board of directors, right? The board of directors, sure, holds the organization in trust for the community. They have a fiscal responsibility for the organization, which to me there's almost an implication that yes, it is a tragic, horrible time, and there is a lot going on, but we still maintain a responsibility and a duty to ensure we're doing everything we can to ensure the financial and philanthropic health of the organization we represent.
Yes, I would agree with that. I would agree with that, period, full stop. Where I think I would depart from a Kantian perspective is that I believe that there are duties that there are multiple duties that an agent has, and those duties get balanced based upon the priority of the duty. So, to give an example of that, I'm as an individual, I have multiple hats that I wear. So I'm an employee, I'm a parent, I'm a husband, and those duties at some point might conflict internally, or they might conflict with another duty that I might have. So if my child commits a crime, my fidelity to my child is not as high, at least in my view, it's not as high as it is to justice or to the law. And so I would force my child to fix the problem or, you know, whatever, or turn them in as the case may be. So in that respect, while I agree that there is, and I wrote a piece for this with Rogare regarding the donor-centered model, and I think ultimately the donor-centered model has entered into as an ethical framework as opposed to a practical kind of element. And while we do have a duty to our employer and we are hired as a fundraiser for our employer, there are times, of course, where if our employer does something wrong, we would have a higher duty that would take precedence. So if our, and I'm not obviously saying that's the case for any of us here, but I'm just saying for argument's sake, if an employer were to violate the law or to violate an ethical principle, to take money and use it for a purpose that the donor didn't intend, then the donor-centered portion might have a priority over my responsibility to my employer. That's all I'm saying.
Let's pretend like, for instance, the 2 to 3 year fundraiser, shows up at AFPI Con or something, or some conference that we're all at, and we're hosting a panel talk on this particular subject. And I also want to sort of insert the Friedman's comment. You know, Friedman's famous quote is the idea of never waste a crisis, mm-hmm. whether it be real or perceived. I tend to think that the tension, the ethical tension that we're talking about, to sort of simplify terms, is we're essentially relating the tension to this notion of sort of the it works pragmatism that utilitarian sort of folks tend to think, as opposed to should it be done differently at different times, for example. And that tends to be where I feel like, going back to your initial comment, Clay, about, you know, what does the young fundraiser maybe need to understand or contemplate or wrestle over if they're not sort of in our league of people who like to talk and use really big words.
Honestly, Jason, two things on this front. The first is, in the very first conversation that I had with you, the first time we did this podcast, and it's well over a year ago, I said to you what has become what I've kind of adapted as sort of the tagline, if you will, for the work that I do, which is that we're mission-driven, donor-centered, data-informed, beneficiary-focused. And I really believe that's what fundraising is. The other side of it, and sorry, getting a little personal, but the reason why I named my company Tactical Solutions is exactly that. That person who's in the seat that has not been fundraised through a crisis before, that, you know, came from marketing, that is for all very good and wonderful and positive and great reasons, is in a development chair, maybe for the first time, and is scrambling to go, you know, what should I do here? What is the right answer? I still tend to think that we are fundraising in the best time that I've ever seen because we have actual data. And that to me is the response, if I understand where you're going with that question, is we have data and we have experience to lean on that we didn't have 20 years ago, that we didn't have 15 years ago. Some of the work that has come out, and I'm thinking specifically of some work that Jeff Brooks from Oceanic did with Steven Screen at the Better Fundraising Company, with a longitudinal study of what the curve looks like in previous crises overlaid, you know, where does fundraising work? Where does it start to dip? You know, comparing to the Great Recession, comparing to, you know, other crises that have impacted fundraising. And we have actual data now that shows us in similar situations, right? This is what happens. So I kind of go to, yes, ethics is great. And we can sit here and Cherry, and I am picking on you a little bit, my friend. Please talk about Immanuel Kant, which makes me want to sing Monty Python songs, but that's a whole other story. You know, we can talk about that, and that's all great and good. But at the end of the day, right, what does that person in that shop do? And that's where I go to, we need to lean on the history and the knowledge and the research and the data that we have, and then be able to make informed decisions as well. So it's not just, you know, we don't want to ask right now because it feels bad to me. There's an actual legitimate decision that is made because of data, because of experience, because we have good, solid information in front of us, not just a gut feeling.
So I obviously 100% agree with that point, and the fact that, you know, quite a bit of what you said in terms of how we have data and our decision should be data informed. What I would say for a new fundraiser or someone who's like, I don't understand or care about these big words, is that in your daily life, whether you're a fundraiser or not, what you do shapes what you do in the future, if that makes sense. So every action that you take shapes every future decisions if you care about consistency internally in your head or just how your actions are interpreted by others. So what I would say is, if if you're new at fundraising and you want to learn about these things, or if you really don't care, the framework to kind of make your decisions is pretty simple. It's what do my actions prohibit, or what do my actions permit in the future? So if I were to be consistent with this principle of don't ask if there's a disease, well, then when would I ever be able to ask? If I say don't ask if there's an economic crisis, then when would I ever be able to ask? And there are a plethora of examples of where people make snap judgments or quick gut check decisions of, I would never take money from an organization that fill in the blank. And I have 400,000 problems with that position, because it's not possible to consistently apply a principle like, I will never take money from fill in the blank type of organization. So, or I will never ask an employee to make a gift, or fill in the blank, you know, all kinds of different scenarios. So where you make an axiomatic claim to say, I will never, or I will always, there needs to be an understanding of what does that axiom then prohibit in the future or permit in the future, and how does that play out? So the only kind of tweaky thing that I would say to Clay as my friend is that I think the difference here in the data set is that our previous data is based upon a certain set of circumstances that helps guide our decision making and kind of gives us enough of a context. And I would be the first to say we should use that context, and Jeff and Stephen have done really good work of shaping, you know, how do we think through these things, and all of their statements, I believe, are really true. I do think that the current crisis, though, is very, very different from previous crises. I think economically, it's very, very different. I think the compounding factor of a healthcare crisis on top of an economic crisis and potentially a political crisis that's occurring all at the same time makes the level of uncertainty a black swan event, unlike a black swan event that we've seen before. So we are sort of in uncharted territory. That doesn't mean that we should freeze and stop acting. We should continue to act based upon what data we have and what data we know, but just more thoughtfully about, if I do this, what could this result in the future?
And I just want to add, because I totally agree, but I just want to quickly add to that, that every crisis before has been a unique situation as well. And sure. Agreed, we've got economic and we've got health and we've got everything hitting at us, but no crisis is ever like the one before. So we're always learning and we're always taking that data from that last time and saying, okay, this is very different, but at least it's something to compare to. There's some sort of data that gives us some level of guide.
Yeah, I just think that the last data, at least when it comes to the economy, is not the most accurate data. So right. Just, and we're talking about ethics, not economy, but I think the last recession was, it was objectively the shortest on history, and the recovery was the fastest in history, whereas all the other recessions since like 1900s have been quite a bit longer in terms of duration and recovery. So
okay, you know. And I'm with you, and let's talk about context, because it's very easy to say fundraisers should be asking right now. Well, yeah, but based on what you just said, in Las Vegas, I mean, we just really came out of the Great Recession last year, maybe. Mm. Right? So the economic situation in some communities may be vastly different than it is in others, which means the donor community is different, which means because there's also a lot of situations and regionalism that affects this too.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I think it also just depends on who you're asking, right? Like, and how you're approaching those things. So as you and I have talked before, CSR is going to look very different. Like giving from businesses is going to look very different. Whereas, and Barbara, our friend Barbara talks about this in her last newsletter. She says the giving's never going to go to zero. We're not going to get to zero charitable giving in this country. It's a question of where the gifts are coming from and, you know, in what combination. So that's where we just need to get smarter as fundraisers from a tactical perspective of really understanding who our donors are, what they care about, you know, where they're capable of giving, and then to look to new frontiers to, blue ocean of where there are new opportunities that we haven't thought through before. And ultimately, the concept of this is the way we've always done it is not going to work for sure this time.
So up until about the last, three months, let's say the last 90 days, I would have said that the philanthropic community and fundraising was trying to, this whole idea of sort of democratizing philanthropy, right? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me like there's some sort of incompatibility with sort of where the world finds itself now and the idea of democratizing philanthropy. And it causes me to sort of critique the timeliness of this notion of Giving Tuesday happening here at the 1st of May, because I tend to think that the people that we wanted to, 6 months ago on Giving Tuesday, like Giving Tuesday in November, the people that we wanted to democratize philanthropy for then could afford to participate in philanthropy. But now we tend to all be sort of, clenching our teeth and biting our nails for fear that the bottom two thirds of our economy, everybody's life just got punched in the gut. Do you guys kind of hear what I'm asking?
Mm-hmm.
I can't and don't necessarily speak to the democratization of philanthropy, but what I feel very strongly is that our profession has in some ways overemphasized the idea that philanthropy belongs to the wealthy. And we have, in doing so, in my opinion, shortchanged donors at all levels. And I tell this story constantly because it, to me, is the loveliest story of fundraising that I've ever experienced. I did an event several years ago now where we invited a young woman to be part of the program and to tell her story. And I just happened to be sitting at the table with her mother and this was a family that was receiving our services. And the young woman told her story. And of course, everybody cried. And then the ask was made and everybody started reaching for the pledge cards on the table. And the mother reached over and started to fill out a card. And I leaned over to her and I said, "You are our guest here. This is your dog. You do not need to do that." And she looked at me with big tears in her eyes and said, "Clay, who am I to accept this help and not make it available for others?" And it just, that story has impacted me, and I hope that it always does, because it says to me, at any level, at what level people are capable of, I believe we have a responsibility. And Sherry and you are going to have this conversation one day about the ethical responsibility of it, but I believe we have a responsibility to make philanthropy open and available to anyone who is able and willing to participate in some way.
You just left the zone of it works, and that our work ought to be in some way should be oriented towards those things that have a value greater than a profit margin. I don't think that the motives for Giving Tuesday now are as pure as like what you just suggested. But I think we have such a convoluted understanding of what philanthropy and fundraising is for.
Yes.
And we've got all of our profit. We've got all the, we've got these various different enterprises and third parties and stuff, and our professional identities all tied up in it.
You know how I feel about this quote, Jason. Henry Nouwen's A Spirituality of
Fundraising. I know. Yes.
Fundraising is expressing our beliefs and mission in such a way that we offer others an opportunity to participate with it, right? And we get into these. I really do think that we fundraisers, we have to hold these thoughts simultaneously. My duty to my organization as an employee to hit that budget goal, but also my responsibility to make philanthropy and to open it up. And I say this because I see so much fundraising that is focused on, just focus on major gifts. We're not going to fool around with all this other stuff. We're just going to focus on major gifts and corporate giving because that's where the money is. Well, personally, I would find it as valuable to have, you know, 1,000 donors giving $35 as I would one $35,000 check. Yes, I have to put the systems and operations and the expense of putting that in place to make that happen. But who are we to say that these people that, you know, for whom $35 is a major gift, who are we to say, no, I'm sorry, you can't participate in our mission. You can't participate in this vision of the world that you believe in.
Clay, you're exactly right. But all you're doing is stating that there is a value that is higher than something else. And you're saying, I want it to be a value that's applied to X rather than Y or Jim rather than Sally. That's really all you're doing. I think we've gotten so tied up in the idea that fundraising has to be defined by this it works pragmatism. And we don't know how to get ourselves untied. And I want to take advantage of this sort of place where we find ourselves now and say, maybe it's time for fundraising to ask itself some really hard questions. And maybe on the other side of this, we'll be better off for it.
Oh, agree.
That's a lot of broken eggs. I will say, I mean, I completely agree. And I mean, I agree with everything you all just said, but I think it's important to recognize that I don't use the word profession when it comes to fundraising. I don't think that we're mature enough as a sector to answer some of the hard questions that some other professions have. So really, like, the example that I use, most of my friends are lawyers, and there is a very clear corpus of literature when it comes, tactically per se, but in terms of what duties are out there, what responsibilities do you have to the law, to clients, to your employer, and those types of things, and how those conflicts play out. And I firmly believe that our as fundraisers, our responsibility to the greater cause of philanthropy is a significant one that we often underplay. And to the specific question, Jason, that you asked about the democratization of philanthropy, it is interesting to see at a contemporary level the political bedfellows that are emerging as a result of what's happening in the environment around us and how those things absolutely make no sense whatsoever. Like, I don't really understand why people are saying some of the things that they're saying, because their worldview, everything that they said before, is diametrically opposed to authoritarianism or to whatever it is. I don't mean to get political, but just to say it's odd. And you have a lot of fundraisers who are focused, for example, on it's all about relationships. It's all about relationships. But there is this counter trend, if you will, against relationship-based fundraising and towards anonymous fundraising, whether that's in the form of donor advised funds or in the form of some of the fundraising that Clay mentioned that happens online. There is this momentum, and I don't know that that's the new trend. I'm not trying to be tactical. I'm just saying that there is an element of how democratization of fundraising does exist. It is a true fact that happens, whether it's through GoFundMe or other funding schemes that are out there. And I'm not going to speak to the motivation of Giving Tuesday now. What I will say is we've never participated in Giving Tuesday in any form of it. But I do think that there are challenges in how that is perceived by the donor community and by the fundraising community that hasn't been fully thought through or fleshed out. As you mentioned, like, we just did a Giving Tuesday and now we're doing another Giving Tuesday. So do we do another one in November? And what's the argument? What's the reason besides organizations need money right now? And aren't there other ways of approaching
it? Right. And they're going to get it from the donors that are the least likely to be able to give that gift, whatever that gift has. We don't have to talk in real dollars at all. We can just say that the people that I'm going to generally that I would assume are going to participate in Giving Tuesday now
are not the donors who are going to be rescuing our organizations. They're not our large 5, 6, and 7-figure donors that we need to see stepping up to the plate right now. They are our, you know, they're the $116 Giving Tuesday donor that right now doesn't have $116 to spare. Because they and two people in their household got laid off in the last 60 days. When I saw that come on my radar, I thought there are so many different people in our sort of convoluted, complex mess of what it means to raise money that profit off of the energy and the enthusiasm that happens on a day like Giving Tuesday, that they just needed to sort of run and create something that may not be particularly timely.
I wish organizations didn't need Giving Tuesday or Facebook fundraisers or GoFundMe or any of those things. Because in an ideal, perfect world, our fundraising would be so based on donor values and inviting that value-based giving, relationship-based giving. Right, we wouldn't need them. I wish we didn't need them, but we do. And in some ways, they are necessary. But what concerns me, and I'll be blunt here, and I know for a fact this is going to come back to bite me when somebody listens to this, right? that instead of doing really good, solid, ongoing, continuing fundraising, we're going to leap to a quote-unquote gimmicky Giving Tuesday Now or Facebook fundraiser or some sort of community thing when what we want, and don't let me put words in your mouth, Jason, but I do think you and I see this very differently, and that's okay. That person that can still afford to give $100 and wants to give $100 because they still believe in, you know, homeless pets or hungry people or, you know, whatever the cause may be, I fear that when we make the decision for them, we leave them out and then we go into a big gimmicky thing. And so they're giving to the gimmick and the adrenaline of the day. And we, again, are surpassing that. They give the care.
Clay, if you were ever in, if you, I don't know that you have ever, you've probably been in the room when I've been speaking. I usually introduce myself as an advocate for the fundraiser, not as an advocate for the donor. And one of the things I want the fundraiser to understand is that, yes, create an opportunity for that $125 donor to give a gift right now. But what I also want her to understand right now is that if she spends the next 6 weeks getting ready for yet another Giving Tuesday Now and doesn't learn how to pick up the phone and call that mid-range donor who can actually put a dent in her bottom line and impress her boss with it and demonstrate that she knows how to have a meaningful conversation with a human being, you know, in a real way, and include a charitable solicitation in the process. That's what I want that young woman or that young man to understand. And I think all the hype that gets sort of built around these things. I remember last year we had our local, you know, give local sort of campaign. And I remember, I think there was about $3 million raised. I think there was about $3 million raised for about 300 charities, which I think equates to, it's like $10,000 or something. I don't know if my math's right, but it wasn't this extraordinary amount of money when you sort of averaged it all out. And $10,000 is just not the type of money that I want the average fundraiser right now to spend weeks trying to secure. I want her or him to know how to pick up the phone and ask for $10,000 of one donor. And the other thing is I don't want their brains so convinced that democratizing fundraising and that asking one donor for $10,000 is in some way evil or wrong or prioritizing that donor over 100 others.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think, Jason, what you just hit as a nail on the head is the fact is my real problem with giving days, whether it's Giving Tuesday or Giving Tuesday now or whatever else it is that we're constructing these artificial things to create concerted effort. And a lot of times these are a lot of work, right? It involves finding matching gifts and having donors that come forward at certain times and all of these things that that are more of a production, and also why I have challenges with certain fundraising events, that it's all the, about the production and not actually about building the, making the case for support and helping people understand it. The reality that we're in right now, and I would say this to anybody involved in any Giving Tuesday thing, is that we are currently in the largest philanthropic focused effort globally that anyone has ever seen. Every measure of social distancing is a love for the other, is a love for humankind. There is a gigantic movement to get to buy local and to take out food from restaurants because you love those restaurants and you want them to survive. These are all demonstrations of philanthropy. It is all around us every single hour of every single day. So we don't need a giving day. It's happening all the time. So go ask someone for $100 and $1,000 and $100,000 every single day. That's all you have to do.
There's a wonderful article, Cherian, that just came out, and I think I shared it with you, or you and I both read it. And it talked about one of the benefits of the situation that they're in, and it stressed connectivity. I mean, yes, we are all desperate to be, well, extroverts are desperate to be in, you know, groups of people and return to, you know, some of those social things and sporting events and bars and public gatherings and all of that. But look at the premise of the article was, look at how we have that human spirit of, we have created connectivity in other ways. We have kept that spirit alive. On the one hand, you can go, oh my gosh, there are so many webinars and Zoom meetings and it's all ridiculous. At the same token, we've simply moved that connectivity to a different level. You're exactly correct and agreed 100%. In some cases, we're sitting and dithering and waiting for a gimmick. We're waiting for a production to do a thing that could have just been done just by building on the connectivity that is happening.
When I think back on my two decades of professional fundraising as an employee, it seemed to have been built by this just constant onslaught of new gimmicks and new ways of doing things. And that was really what our expertise got really tied up in. That's what, you know, when we went to conferences and when we were talking, you know, critically, we were really just talking about highly technical things that could be put in an owner, you know, in a technical manual or something. I can't remember the number of times that I've been in grant writing workshops where you were, you know, highly technical sort of stuff. And I kind of wonder if maybe this critical moment for us in our profession, and this gets back to Cherian and your comment about us not being a profession, quote unquote, yet, is maybe this is a time for us to grow up a little bit and say, hey, do we really need another gimmick? Or do we just need to recognize that we're all doing this every day and we're doing it quite well?
Again, to some of the points of what can, you know, versus getting into big word discussions, right? What can the new or the small shop or the person that's just entered the fundraising world recently? 1968, Harold J. Cy Seymour, Designs for Fundraising, one of among the first books on how to fundraise ever published. I read it every year. I wish it were in every fundraiser's library, because what he said in 1968, without, you know, when it was carbon paper and 3x5 cards and typewriters, without any of the technology, without any of the stuff that we have, it was true then and it's true today. So the gimmickier or the more flashy fundraising gets, I sometimes fear that we move away from the principles. We get to volume rather than quality and lose that context of what relationship-based fundraising really and truly means, because those principles, what is that, 52 years, are alive and well and good and valuable now, even with all of the methodologies and different systems that we have now.
That's Clay. That's why I cringe, not cringe. That's why I kind of shift in my seat when I hear my colleagues, our colleagues talking about data and information. And I know you're one of the data information guys, and you appreciate what data can help us know. But I tend to think that it has a darker side, and it's a darker side that plays out very often in fundraising. And that is that it is what allows that efficiency and that volume to happen. And so we miss that qualitative side of the work. You know, when I think about my very few conversations I've had with you, I tend to hear what I think I'm hearing, Clay, is this inherent tension in what you appreciate about our work between the very qualitative and the very quantitative sort of sides of what we do. And I tend to think that you probably are very much in love with the more qualitative side, but the quantitative side always wins over.
I just want to address that data point because I'm a direct response guy. I'm somewhat of a digital guy. I'm a data guy. But I fully believe to the tips of my toes that all of those tools are only there to get us to the relationship. Analytics for analytics' sake is, I mean, what's the point? Right.
Yeah.
Unless we're looking at the data in terms of what the data tells us to understand how to build more effective relationships, then it's just, you're just looking at reports. So, you know, good for you. Same thing with direct response is very often singled out as a numbers game. And that is true. But the best direct mail is direct mail that is through the techniques that work, identifying and finding those donors that do believe and that do value the mission, and the rest, you know, can go somewhere else. It's about finding those donors that believe in what you're doing. All of our tools are there to get to that core. And that's what I fear we miss when we're focused on, you know, I think we're saying the same thing, Jason, actually, right? We're focused on bells and whistles.
I think we are. Clay, I think we are. But how many of the experts and gurus in sort of the direct response space are even a part of these conversations at this level where they'd get on a podcast and banter around with three of their peers? I just don't see that in some of the more, what I would consider some of our more senior experts. I think this could be a turning point where our generation of leadership may be able to step up and say, we're going to think a little more critically about this. And fundraising as a result is probably going to mature a little bit.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important in our sector right now, is to say we need to take our heads up and look ahead at not just the tools in front of us, but why the tools are relevant at every mm-hmm. level. So right now you're seeing a lot of, you know, how to virtualize your event, or how to, you know, do X and Y with fundraising events or with data and whatnot. And it really loses track of why those things are relevant. You don't actually need an event to get gifts, but we've ingrained in people so much that that's the time, that's the day when we ask for gifts. And whether it's Giving Tuesday or direct mail or a grant proposal, we've prioritized the tool over the value that we're trying to obtain. And we need a seismic shift in the sector to reevaluate really what our priorities are and why the tools exist at all.
Yeah, guys, I have had your. I think we're all slightly a little exhausted, but I'm sure we can keep going. But we're holding on to our listeners' attention quite well, even at 50 minutes. If somebody's listening to our conversation and they want to find you, Clay, how would you suggest that they do that?
Oh, the best place is probably tweet me at @tclaybuck. I'm pretty easily found. You can also find me online at tcbfundraising.com.
Yeah. And Cherian, how would you suggest that someone finds you?
I'm usually the one liking Clay's awful puns on Twitter. So my Twitter handle is Cherian_CHERIAN_KOSHY, or you can find me on LinkedIn.
Good deal, guys. Well, you're always welcome back. You guys hold on for a moment. I'm gonna stop the recording and we'll...
Thanks so much, Jason. Thanks for having us.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.